welcome everybody to the Gloucester Writers Center. It's great to have some new faces here and some old faces, old friends, I mean, not old faces. Your faces look young and fresh. We're very happy to have Nadine Boughton and Scott Witham here tonight. Chef, what's a poem? I'm ready.
Well, it's a historical piece.
Okay.
Gloucester history.
More than one way.
About a character from the 1890s, and it goes like this. James Merry, and it's true, James Merry was a fisherman back in days of yore. But he left the blue in 92 for the trade of matador. So he got a bull, and he raised it up full, and he learned the corrida lore. Then he died like a toad on the Dogtown Road, bleeding from a stomach gore.
Well, that's a nice delicate poem for us. Now, if you are up for an adventure, you can walk up to Dogtown, and a little bit up Dogtown Road, if you look to the right. There's some great blueberries there in the right season, but there's also a stone that marks where Mary was gored and where Mary died. Wow. So there's the gruesome truth. Scott, we're glad to have you back with us. Scott Witham's new book of poems, Doors Out of the Underworld, will be published, well, has been published by Mad Hat Press in October of 2019. Witham has been a recipient of the Plowshare Cohen Award and the Two Rivers Review Chapbook and Drunken Boat Pan Literary Prizes. His first book, Arson and Prophets, came out with Ashland Poetry Press. Recent poems have been published by Agni, Antioch Review, Beloit Poetry Journal, Diagram, Indiana Review, Plowshares, Plume, and elsewhere. We're very excited to have Scott Witham here with us tonight.
Book of Poetry is, there are probably half of the poems are smaller prose poems that are very fabulistic but very modern in that they're cast in modern world. The others are more lyrical. The book is divided into, because of the length of some of the poems, six or eight sections of about six or seven poems each. The cover, of course, is Van Gogh's Cypresses. And I didn't know this until the editor and publisher of this book told me that cypresses were known as a tree or a place that someone could come in or out of the underworld. So, and so the book is divided. Each section has a small little cypress tree. So this, I just want you to know too, these poems are very wacky. They often have animals speak, pears speak, people speak. This, and I use that sort of, I don't know, device quite a bit in this book. And I've started another book and the same device is happening again. So this particular poem's titled Bob Being a Manhole. Bob comes up in this older book and comes up in the newer book. This came out of a woman that I still work with. I'm almost retired now. We have lunch almost every day, and she was going through a divorce, and her ex was always, he was this person that would, she would get up in the morning with her daughter, and they would be in their pajamas till 11 or 12 reading books. And her husband, her ex-husband would say, Tracy, people don't do that. Mm-hmm. And she would say, what do you mean, what people? You know, and that just started off this longer thinking about what it would be like if somebody was just an ass, all, you know, but did the same thing all the time. And this is where Bob being a manhole comes up. These people are sort of trapped in doing the same thing day in and day out. Bob being a manhole. One hot summer night, Judy and Bob met and within minutes saw in each other's eyes their future together. made fantastic love, collapsed into that completely relaxed post-coital state, dozed off, and never woke. They continued together in a dream. In it, they kept waking, each time in an early morning after stroll, in an empty street, chalk with manholes, the manholes flushing steam all at once. It was hard to see much of anything except with what was right in front of their faces. Judy said that she would really like to fall into an opened manhole, and Bob didn't hear her desperation created by his continual need to correct her, as in, "Judy, people don't say opened manhole, people say an open manhole." What people? As they walked through that fog-like steam, right in front of Bob, a manhole slowly opened its thick cover like the maw of a whale. "Judy," Bob said, "how about this, a manhole opening?" Which, at that moment, sounded like a concession, a chance for reconciliation. But by then, Judy had it with Bob. "Any opening," Judy said. She brushed by Bob and jumped down the manhole. Its cover clanked shut. Below the street, though, there was drumming, as if from pistons of a huge machine, and there was the continual hiss of steam, and the steam clouds engulfed Judy. Yet above it all, she clearly heard Bob confiding in, no, correcting some stranger. But who? It's then the manhole spoke. "Think about it, Judy. We have something quite special, quite different going on here." "That's true," Judy said, "but you're a manhole." "Right," the manhole said, "but at least you know exactly what you've jumped into." "All right," Judy said, "then tell me, manhole, what would our lives look like were we to live together?" "I wouldn't open my mouth again," the manhole said, "and you could escape out another manhole." But when Judy climbed out farther up the street, there stood Bob. How did he know which manhole to go to every time? There were so many others. So Bob is one character, keeps coming back. So as I said, there are some poems in this book where inanimate objects speak. This particular poem is called, I'm also sort of, not sort of, I am interested in innocence and childhood, and I think there's that dreamlike quality in a lot of these poems. This particular poem is titled "The Smallest No." Under the sign that said produce, three lifetime clerks in long white coats quietly stacked pears, till one clerk said, "I've noticed the shape of hourglasses in the relief of the packed pears." And the second clerk chimed, "Time relieves nothing." "Initially, even a bruise can be succulent," said the third clerk, and sighed. Out of them all, one pair spoke. "But don't let anything stand for long. Sit, stop it, get back where you belong, you little shit," screamed a mother to her son, who had unbuckled himself from a shopping cart shaped like a fire truck. "Man, there's our future," said the first clerk. There was a hissing sound, the green produce being misted from overhead. "The child thinks that heaven is crying," said the second clerk. "The smallest no," the pair said. "Then what would you suggest?" asked the third clerk. "Get busy," said the manager as he approached. "As usual," said the first clerk, "he's going to give that boy a piece of fruit to shut him up." "Hand him the talking pear," said the second. "Shine it," said the third. "Shine it. This also has children in it. The title of this is The Leader. Just like Amanda, you know, it's so hard to talk about some of the things that are happening in this country, or to, I mean, I said what I said about binary, and I actually think, like, how stupid that was. I say things all the time that, you know, that I wished I hadn't said, but I think that, you know, what's going on in this country in terms of leadership. I looked at this poem the other day, and I thought, I probably wrote this 10 or 15 years ago, and I think it reflects in a way a lot of what's going on. So, I'm not applying it to any particular person, but you'll see where it gravitates, the leader. It got dark really fast while the seven small children gazed into their first campfire. Man, right here, right now, this is heaven. This is what it's all about, said Dave, their burly leader. Half nods only out of the kids. How would they know? What could they really see? As best as they could tell, the hot whole chicken legs Dave just dragged from the coals and placed at their feet were singed crisp black, the foil wrap melded to the skin. To the youngest child, the legs looked like little open books whose covers dimly reflected the big fire. Each child had just begun his or her book. Dave fetched himself one and immediately broke its back. It gurgled. Well, what are you waiting for? Dave said. This is as good as it gets. Not done. Mine's not done, whimpered the youngest. Dave sighed, tipped his head skyward, and under his breath mumbled, there's always one. That's when a star fell, one with a long tail. The youngest sprang up, went crashing through the woods after it. Just as quickly, the remaining children followed. Hey, what are you doing? Come back, Dave hollered. When it got too quiet, he stood up and looked around, puzzled at those glittering books. Don't be silly, he yelled out. They never make it all the way down here. Come on, he yelled again. We'll throw them back in. Who? Went the youngest child. Who? The rest of the children joined in. Who? Who? So, I mean, I like to play around with innocence, but also the seriousness of like what sometimes seems comical. I'm going to switch a little bit to some of the lyrical pieces. This is a quicker piece. Everyone knows what a surf clam is? Mm-hmm. I think they're more often on the Cape or where there's a lot more surf. They're long, so almost like razor blade clams. Mm-hmm. But they have their orange tongue. It looks almost like a tongue, and it sort of drags out, and they use the tongue to propel themselves into surf. What a nice place, by the way. You're all fortunate you have this place to come to. I was saying to Amanda, I live in Marblehead now, and there is no place where people can get together, especially artists or writers or people who are interested in either. I'm reminiscing. I just found myself present at our last beach trip. How many summers ago? Wading in, we spotted a surf clam. It had a creamy orange tongue twice as long as its shell, which helped it launch into the sweep of a passing wave, as I am doing. And don't clams feeding filter every grain from wherever they land? I cherish life so much that I wish to live it all again. But wasn't the far off just as bright and beautiful, even though we missed it, our heads elsewhere? One hell of a way to travel, you said, as the clam vanished. We tried to follow it till someone else called us in, as happens, as it will. Now, I've just had this book for about 2 or 3 weeks, and I've read 3 times, and I find myself already anxious to try new stuff. So I may do it right here.
Do it.
Yeah, that's what you're here for, right? This title of this poem is Some Opera. It does use sort of counterpoint of Mary Cassatt's painting at the opera, where she's, you know, that painting, it's like the MFA, where she's in an opera, but she's got opera glasses or spy glasses, and she's not paying attention to a damn thing going on stage. She's looking at everybody in the crowd, right? So it uses this a little bit, but it's not, it's only used as a device. Some opera. Some backgrounds in Mary Cassatt's oil paintings, the detailed patterns on walls, furniture, and clothing dominate. Close up, attention drains. Off the real subject is the real subject. My mother-in-law has Cassatt's tastes, the patterns, the finery in the background. Decoration so that everything holds together, though it never does, moves in and out like spyglasses in the hands of Cassatt's lady at the opera, ogling somebody who must be somebody in the box, caring nothing for what unfolds on stage because it's better off. The phone rings. My panicked mother-in-law tells me a wren's trapped in her house. Can I come over, get it out? Sure, I'll see what I can do. The outcome isn't the matter. It's about loneliness. It's always there when you look the other way. At least once a week, the VCR is on the fluke. The computer won't do what she wants it to do. She can't open the bottle of pills. Any excuse for human contact. Some opera. The bird is only background, and it's not singing. Here, she says, put on these gloves. With the help of binoculars, I've watched wrens sing. They give it everything they've got. Like my mother-in-law, up close, the bird's terrified, broken. But do you think it really lets me grab hold? It reverberates around the living room off those busy little print walls. Anybody keeping track of time? Because I'm not. So, if somebody just, you know, what time did we start, Amanda?
Much later than intended.
Quarter of. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. So I'll just read 3 more poems. Is that okay with you?
Sure.
Okay. So I adopted 3 kids from South America, and the last child was a sort of a quick turnaround, and she is African descent. And it was, I never, you know, I remember talking to the social worker, and there was a lot of talk about what this means to be a white parents raising an African child. What that meant in white culture, what that meant in black culture, and what that was, you know, what problems might crop up. And for the most part, I never saw, I can think of one instance when my daughter Lucy was in the hospital, an African-American woman approached me. Lucy had been up all night with some stomach thing. Her hair looked like hell, you know. And this African-American woman came up to me and said, you need to do something with her hair. And I said, she's been sick all night. And but then, you know, she actually showed me how to do her hair differently. And so those things happened a lot. But initially when we were adopting, it was from Ecuador. And this is about an incident that took place there that sort of really shocked me. Title is Garish. Scent of hibiscus. The overpowering perfume of our maid. The skirt of the foyer light she stood under, placing her in a Fifth Avenue display. The length and curving back of her pink nails, petals of a jungle flower. The tips of those petals peeling back, the blanket swaddling our adopted daughter like a flower inspecting a seed in its pod, if that were possible. The baby powder rubbed all over our baby's face, worked in. The maid sang, "Oh, oh, so dark, so dark," all the while stroking between thumb and index finger, deftly, no nails touching, the flesh of our baby's broad nose. The assured look on the maid's face, which said, "Anyone can do it. Begin now, and you may stretch, thin, straighten it out." One after the other, she drew our weary hands close and showed us the way. Never mind that we had been lost in that winding city built by conquerors. Never mind the dark 16th century church for a moment sealing off the chaos and confusion outside. Never mind the diffused light of the dome like a flower head drawing us toward it, and once under it, how our eyes strained into it. Never mind that we had argued over which one of us had said it. Garish, the stiff arms of Christ's bursting through sparkling walls, like heroes or thieves who could not be stopped. It didn't matter who. Still gives me shivers. Okay, I'll try a new one, and I'll just back into something that I know. So, I grew up upstate New York near the Seneca Army Depot in the Finger Lakes area. And when I was growing up as a kid, it was a SAC Air Force base, and I'm sure some of you remember drills that were based on the Cuban Missile Crisis. And but as a kid, you may remember that, but even before then, the sonic booms were always, like, I'd be out someplace in the field walking or with friends, or we'd be playing something, and there'd be this huge, like a jet would just scream over, and this big boom. So I did grow up around a military base. I stayed in this area most of my life. There were a lot of kids that came and went, but this uses that background. The title of the poem is Off Base. But the character that I was most interested in is, as a kid, there was a strange woman that I grew up in a very small town, like 600 people, and it was just a main street, nothing. And but there was occasionally this woman would drive through and pull over into the post office in her car, and I know you see this because I still see it. The car was just chock full of newspapers, magazines, and I'm sure she was homeless or wandering around, but it fascinated me. And so this is the poem called Off Base. Fuel long ago, that car filled to the rear window with newspapers and monthly magazines, those mixed with white envelopes, all loosely cascading over the front seat, pooling on the floor around the feet of the woman driving it, the woman we called the woman with a car full of newspapers. Always coming out of nowhere, but once sighted by us kids hanging on the street called, "Emergency landing!" For loaded down as she was, she tipped a wing too far, rolled, spilled, caused an explosion, because as it was, when she pulled over, she dug out, popped the sprung door, boom, pushed back leaking papers in front of the post office, brushed off, straightened on her way in to see Stuart, the postal clerk. Stuart, called Stump. Not as a result of explosions, more because he stood there and cut to the obvious. Like B-52's up there refueling again. Though, never a word to the woman with a car full of newspapers. Just the exchange. For her, an unclaimed magazine or newspaper, an occasional dead letter that Stump saved, that Stump told us once we were ready to take it, was the least anyone deserved, a place, even if it wasn't real. Fuel now, the sound barriers breaking, the usual living off base, or to see, then, a B-52 refueling in flight, to pinpoint high overhead two shiny bodies connected by what looked like a plastic straw in a milk carton. Okay, time for Nadine and time for me to close out here. Thanks so much for giving me an opportunity to sound a few things out here and try a few things from this book. I like it a lot, and I like reading a lot. So it's really nice to be to get opportunities. And I've found like this with this second book, life has changed, writing has changed, opportunities have changed. Like it's not as easy to get venues. I mean, bookstores, you know, they want to know your pedigree, and so it's really nice. It's very nice of Amanda to. Invite me up, and very nice to be in Vincent's home. I didn't know that this is what it was. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Kind of honored to stand here. I ran into Vincent years ago. I was as a student. I was telling Henry this. Elizabeth McKim comes here a lot. I was at Lesley College when I think I was probably in my 20s or something. And Elizabeth was my first teacher. I just saw her last week, and you know, now I'm going around saying she was my first. I think I'll end on something wacky. This is called Pastoral. If I can find a page number. And I read this last week and ended on it. I like it because it is sort of funny and fun, and it's fun to read. The last line is so that everyone gets up and runs together, and there is an idealistic bent to this poem that I like in terms of an ending, because I like the idea of, I still believe we all should be running together in some way or another. There are lots of names in this, Ed McMahon, Johnny, reference to Johnny Carson, Johnny Weissmuller, Gerald Ford, Johnny Rivers. Pastoral. Oh, to stretch out in a meadow with a few friends, be approached by goats without names, not Marble Waite or Billy Sue, but goats 606, 608, 722. To move off, break into song, they given you a number and take away your name. For Ed McMahon to come up in a different field, because that's who does. And Johnny Weissmuller, because the man who sang the Secret Agent song, his name's Johnny what? Rivers. But really, only Babbling Brooks. Oh, anyway, Weissmuller, because he's the one who could really swim anywhere. And lo, to wrestle fake alligators in those breeches, lo, the golf swing of these my breeches, not a soul hurt or killed. Gerald Ford, saying what? That it's the numbered average days that bonk, that made me roam as far as I did. Meanwhile, under the clouds of a bald day, missing the friends I loved and who loved me? No way. Oh, to return and among loving friends announce, let's mark well our days together and our goats too. Give them names like Weissmuller and McMahon. Make them all count, as our children do right now by playing in the barn behind us, all so that one of us asks, what do you think's going on up there? It's gone awfully quiet. So that everyone gets up and runs together. Thanks.
Thank you. That was great.
Nadine Boughton is a writer, poet, collage artist, coach, and teacher. Her writing has been published in literary journals, trade books, and presented in a number of venues. She studied writing and voice with teachers in the oral tradition, including David White. Nadine's visual art is represented by the Matthew Swift Gallery in Gloucester. It is exhibited, collected, and published internationally. She is a creativity coach in private practice, and we're very happy to announce that Nadine will be leading a workshop here at the Gloucester Writers' Center in January on The Voice. So keep an eye out for that in our email blast. Remember to put that out there. But that will be coming out. Very excited to have, as you all are, to have Nadine here to share her work. Thank you.
So, welcome everybody. Thanks for coming out in the dark and cold. I really, really appreciate it. I want to thank Henry and Amanda for this opportunity and for the space. Thank you. So, we turn the clocks back. We're one more step down into the descent. So I got out my seasonal poems that just seem like a good place to start. This is older work. And the first one's called Thanksgiving, and it was written when my husband Otto and I lived in the city, Boston, and we were driving north for Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving. Traveling north to the land of live free or die, beyond the black tentacles of city smoke and the highway's icy snarl, there is that moment. We take any side road, park the car, march into the woods, and stop. Our bodies are like metal clocks, old Big Bens, clunky and hard. Standing in the new snow, amazing things fly out of us. Coiled springs and sprocket wheels, a broken bell, a second hand. Numbers drop from our faces, all of our rusted parts whited out. We stare at a stand of fir trees that stare back at us. From their green robes, birds fly. From their darkened center, magnetic poles wake us from the dream of time. Moisture breaks on our faces, blown from the boughs. A cloud of breath blown from the boughs. We are real, they say. We are real. So, in 1990, I met David White, and for those of you who don't know who he is, he's sort of a Celtic bard who delivers poems. They're all memorized. They're just kind of fly out of his body. Yana knows. And so after the first weekend we spent with him, it was kind of a declaration where I decided I would write. It was a kind of a commitment to oneself that you make. So It's really a poem about voice. It's called The Wind Howls. The wind howls, every leaf surrenders, leaving the last gray tree naked. Clouds toss close to my head. A cold wind cuts through me, shaking loose everything extra. I crouch low to the ground. In the darkness of my cupped hands, a tiny orange flame spreads through crumpled leaves, sticks choked by dryness. I breathe gently into the deadened places, uninhabited for so long, and beg you, rise up and speak. Good to reread that now and then. If there was ever a time to speak for all of us, this is it, right? This was also written in 1990 after the death of my mother. It's called In Praise of Matter. In Praise of Matter. When my mother was dying and still up and moving through her final days, she bled from her womb like a last hurrah, a final embrace between crone and maid at the edge of a cliff where the bag of bones is dropped. But it was also the ordinary world. We sat in the lamplit waiting room of the gynecologist, between the hum of pregnant bellies and the blue world of a fish tank. My mother slid her feet into poised chrome stirrups while I stood at her head, both of us splitting off from the man at the other end until his hand waved before me saying, "Come look." And my mother's Mona Lisa smile led me to stand before her mystery, unveiled beneath the hot glare of floodlights. He parted the grayish lips and, like a flower parting in time-lapse photography, I saw petals of flesh rotate in kaleidoscope movements, pink gateways swirling open to a raspberry center. Now here is the area of inflammation of the urethra, his voice said. But my ears were pressed to tunnel walls where the sound of the river carried my blue-bound body rushing to that crowning moment, lungs' first taste of air. And I thought how extraordinary the design to be brought before the doorway of her tanned skin tarp, to sing in praise of matter, mater, my mother, while she lay withering on autumn ground. So this poem I wrote in 2012, and it's about the Sandy Hook killings, and we're coming up on the 7-year anniversary. It was December 16th, 2012. And I read this to honor children, to honor the children everywhere, and to honor ourselves as keepers of children. And it's called Keepers of Children. They hid them in closets and cabinets, brushed them like a flock of sparrows into the warm room with the kiln, gave them bits of paper to color, they pretended. Pretended that the popping sounds were only a drill they'd hid like this before. The keepers read to the children, choked on words, caught in the throat. After a long time in the locked and darkened space where they all pretended, after the silence filled with the unimaginable, tall policemen with shiny badges, the smell of leather and guns, came to lead them from their caves. The uniformed keepers helped them form a chain, holding hands. "Don't look," they said to the children as they stumbled past the 6 and 7-year-olds who lay in pools of blood, holding hands, gunned down in mid-flight, hair flung, their dress full of delicate details, a Christmas tree pin, reindeer barrettes. The children snaked through the dark halls, filled with an awful smell, only opening their eyes when the stiff December air hit them. Parents, half crazy, with a look in their eyes they would never forget, rushed at them, threw their coats around their tiny frames to keep them warm, to keep them. After great longing, the wild orchid appears, sets down its tubular feet in the softened walls of the heart. Breathing in, tendrils wrap their arms around your hunger. Breathing out, pink light sprays across the chest. A sweet mist aerates the mind, and grief gives way to rainforest, purple orchids spinning. So, I'm going to move into some new work that's pretty different. I look at all of this as works in progress as you tinker forever with things, but here's how they are now. As a lot of you know, I'm also a visual artist, and I've never been able to focus on the two at the same time. So I'm kind of delighted to be back into the word again. And after the big show at Matthew Swift's gallery this summer, we went to Maine, and I woke up one morning and said, okay, it's time, I'm gonna write. And then I realized that it was our wedding anniversary. So this is called Anniversary, and it's a love poem. 22 years ago, we gathered flowers, made an altar at the edge of Round Pond. "I do," we said softly, slipping gold bands on our fingers. This morning we eat dark bread, a light swirl in its center. Sun burns away feathers of clouds over Toddy Pond. A German boy skips in the water with his dog, while his father puffs smoke rings. Otto reads Petrarch while I take Simic to the John. Ingrid carries bowls of chrysanthemums down the hill, an angel's whiteness in petals, freshly ironed pillowcases. 1 week we've been nestled by the lake, riding its surface in kayaks. Stars streaming through space, we hardly know where we are. I do makes a long path of nows as wrinkles form their own. My ankle swells as do our hearts. All is the pure land. Essence glows from all things. My straw hat hangs from a nail. Faint shadows from pines dance round its brim. May it grace my head till my hair turns thin and gray. 22 more years with you at the edge of a lake. I used to read that, and the two of us would sit there with the Kleenex just so I was able to get through it. Let's see. A writer I've been very passionate about, who's a philosopher and ecologist and shaman and many things put together, but he writes so beautifully about the movement from oral culture to the written word. And so I was reading his latest book while I was in Maine at the edge of the lake. And I just made some notes here that the alphabet language became experienced as an exclusively human power. So the rest of the world kind of recedes, and it's like we're the only species speaking, right? So the oral culture, a life of the senses, and it's really a lot about embodiment. You know, language began with sound from the body conversing with the other species of the world. So the songful dimension is part of the oral ancestors. Sounds of the world. The alphabet screwed up everything. Left us letters with no leaves rustling. No birds announcing dawn. Tiny fingers drew sticks and circles between straight lines. Contorted mouths felt for something called phonetics, a kind of braille for the tongue, bitter and sharp. Sounds of the world fade when all things speak like we do. Dogs discuss food in their bowls. Sponge mops wax poetic over their sheen. Stop talking. Already the loons are silent. No eggs laid this year. The pines stand mute, holding history. Even their cones drop to the ground without a sound. This is another love poem. It's kind of fun to read. It's I was thinking about wonder. And I think I always think about wonder, especially like in these times. And I actually remember that in my high school yearbook, you had to have a little saying after your name, and people had Socrates and people. But I had a line from Lawrence Ferlinghetti, and it said, "And I am perpetually and forever waiting, awaiting a renaissance of wonder." So it's been with me a long time. And, you know, aging is a funny thing, how this changes, right? So, Wonderland. In Wonderland Park, strapped into giant teacups, we tilted and spun on tracks worked by the hands of a Mad Hatter. At 14, tilting meant lifting my mouth to meet your mouth in a ballet of tongues under stars spinning like Ferris wheels. Lucy in the sky with diamonds, naked in the Rockies, we were higher than mountains. God spoke in a chorus of wolves. The long view comes down to this, a slant of morning light grazes your Einstein hair, spun white with wonder. Milk swirls in a teacup. The other person I kind of spent the summer with is the work of Charles Simek. I'm just mad about his form and his humor and his darkness. And so some of these represent me playing with that, like really minimalist, very image and very plain language. So we had a house painted, and this was the poem that came out of it. It's called Blessing. Blessing. Guatemalan house painters on ladders out every window, their black hair smooth as their brushes, spreading paint on trim. No radio, only soft murmurs in Spanish. No clock, they paint till dusk. Buenas noches, they wave from their truck. Tarps lifted off marigold beds. Everything breathes night air. And you are beside me on fresh sheets in our honey house with a paprika red door. So I'll just read a couple more. And this goes back to Abrams' work again, or this work about the oral and the world being overtaken with humans speaking. And so technology, I mean, the written word's great, right? And it brought us all these marvelous things. But sort of where technology has brought us lately, the alphabet is more like mirrors rather than windows looking out to the world. The alphabet is these mirrors, and that we're constantly reflecting the human back upon itself. So all of these screens and everything's in English, and we're just talking away to ourselves in the big, huge biosphere of other species is just drifting away. And you see this in advertising. So here we go. It's called Human Speak. Vanished from North America, 30 million birds, 30 million songs gone. Habitats too hot, too dry, too wet. Two vanished. Now birds speak English in our living rooms where flat screens glow, where landscape becomes scenery. The owl is best and brightest with a British accent, lounging poolside in a terry cloth robe, advisor for trips we can fly to. Big birds are popular too. Turkeys and ducks, they're just like us. Oh, what those wings can do. Now they sell comfort in a language we know. Liberty, mutual, accident, forgiveness. When the only song left is human speak, when the great accident completes our mutual demise, who will forgive us? And it was Mary Oliver that several years ago talked about this, and it was sort of like, wow, I never thought of that. You know, she was always so annoyed that everything was anthropomorphized, you know. Mm-hmm. So my last poem is very recent. I wrote it at this wonderful event sponsored by the Writers Center, which was the first annual Dogtown Writers Festival. And the theme was place. And it was just a wonderful exploration of all the things that that could mean. So I was in the poetry group, and I'll end with this. My body is a lake. My body is a lake. Loons bury eggs on my shores. The sky and I converse all day. Each cloud colors my mood. All is surface. Water spiders in crazy go-karts circle and bump. Teens pumped on testosterone, speed and projectile boats, slap, slap. At night, constellations thread my body, groin to forehead, hip to toe. Dippers dip, I am sheathed in milk. I yield, I reflect on the endless wheel of time, but someday I'll get to the bottom, past fish, past the sunken boat, down through the silken darkness, where surely the great prize waits in a field of scalding light. Mm-hmm.